Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
We are live on Inside the Hive. I am your host, Nick Bilton.
And I'm John Kelly, editor of The Hive, and Nick's friend.
Not John Kelly, the guy who runs the White House, right?
No, we get confused for each other all the time, and as I say frequently, my father, who is also a John F. Kelly, was born in Boston, like 15 minutes away at around the exact same time. If nothing else, it's just a sign that if you're from Boston and you're Irish, your name is probably going to be John Kelly.
My condolences. So we're going to jump in really quick to my guest, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of a synopsis of what we talked about today. I had this guy, Jeff Aralowski, on. He's a filmmaker. He was he was on the shortlist for an Oscar for a documentary he just did called Chasing Carl. And I thought that this week's podcast was going to be kind of like a nice, grounded conversation in climate change, and it turned into a terrifying conversation about the sixth extinction, where we may be like at the beginning of the end for humanity. It was kind of terrifying, but you know, it's a really interesting conversation. So I'm excited.
Oh, I can't wait to hear, Nick. I've always pondered how our entire species is going to go extinct. So
it's fascinating. We'll talk about it more after the interview, but we've had five major extinctions that started around 439 million years ago, and you know, corals dying and plant life dying off and dinosaurs and you name it, and there's a lot of people that think we are the beginning of the next one, and it could be the end of us. So we better jump in before that happens.
And just a very quick tease, after your conversation, we're going to ponder what will go extinct first, humanity or Facebook, based on a recent column that you wrote.
All right, let's jump in. So my guest today is Jeff Aralowski, who is from Boulder, Colorado, is that right?
From New York, but I live in Boulder.
From New York, yeah. who flew out to LA this week to talk to us, and he is a filmmaker who has done several films, and one of which is on the short list for an Oscar for documentaries called Chasing Coral. So I watched the movie this week, and it's incredibly sad. It's a documentary about climate change and some of the effects on it. Can you just give the listeners a you know, I would say 140 characters, but we don't do that
sure.
anymore. It's a 280 character version of what the film
yeah.
is about.
I try not to think of it as a sad movie, personally, but
it's pretty sad.
It can be sad, and I think it does depend on the audience. But we learned about this phenomenon of coral bleaching, and we built a team and had to build new camera technology to try to go out and document this phenomenon. The scientists have known about it for a while. As the oceans warm, corals turn white, and then ultimately they die. And that's never really been documented properly. And so our team went out on this quest to go, you know, travel the oceans and find the story.
So one of the things that I find really interesting is when I first was introduced to you and watched them, before I watched the film, I was like, oh, coral? Like, that's boring.
Yeah.
You know, why would I want to talk to someone about coral? Like, it's not a big deal. And
yeah.
And then I started watching the movie, and you start to see this thing happen where 29% of coral around the world died just last year alone,
yeah.
and
yeah.
and you see the effects happening, and it is like it's one of the saddest things
I've ever seen. Sad. It is a sad story. We tried to make it entertaining and fun, which I think we did a good job at. But it is this, like, the state of the planet is not good right now. Like, the planet is really suffering some major catastrophes.
So, and that's the thing that for me that was so fascinating about watching this is that you get to see that in real time. You get to see the before and after as it's happening. So can you, what brought you to this? Why coral?
Just like you were saying, I knew nothing about coral. I knew nothing about the ocean. I went scuba diving a couple times in college and didn't. In retrospect, I now realize that those places that I went diving were not really healthy, and they were just boring, bad sites. And so I never got the ocean bug, and I never did it again. And then when this project started, Richard, one of the subjects of the film, he reached out to us. He had seen our previous film, Chasing Ice, and we did something similar conceptually. We were documenting climate change through glaciers. We wanted visual evidence of what's happening to glaciers. And so we did time lapses of that. Richard had seen that project, and he reached out to us and started telling us about what was happening in the ocean. And I knew nothing about corals. I didn't care about them much. And the entire, first several months was this huge education for me about just how essential and important this ecosystem is. Coral, first of all, I can geek out now about corals. Corals are pretty fascinating. They are both plant and animal and rock, all in the same really simple organism. It's as simple as it gets, but it's also as complex as it gets in this beautiful way. And this tiny little plant-animal relationship can make a huge structure that is the home for billions of fish all around the planet. And they are the backbone of the ocean. Like, you can't have a healthy ocean without a healthy coral reef system. And we are literally on path to destroy and annihilate all coral reefs around the planet.
So before we get to the film and all the things that you show in it and the documenting that you do, what happens if we continue on this trajectory where in a decade there is no more coral?
That's a really, really great question, and it's one that's really, really complicated to answer because we've never run an experiment like this before. We have lost individual species, right? We've lost this species, that species. People talk about losing species all the time. We've never lost an entire ecosystem before. And that's what we're doing. Like, we are on path to lose an entire ecosystem for the very first time. What the consequences of that, we don't know. But it's not good, right? So when the scientists say we don't know what's going to happen, it's not like it's good versus bad. It's like, is it bad versus effed? You know, how bad is it going to be?
You can say fuck on this. We're not NPR.
So it's the real challenge there. It's like all of nature is this house of cards. And if all of these ecosystems feed each other, just like the human body, like all of your organs are working together in unison to allow your body to function. And all of these different ecosystems on the planet are feeding each other, and they've provided the stability. Like, our oxygen comes from the ocean. Like, the majority of our oxygen comes from the ocean. If the ocean isn't healthy, there are many scientists that I know that are very worried that we're going to be losing oxygen. We've already hit peak oxygen. Like, if that's not the biggest wake-up call, I don't know what else can make people care more than a loss in oxygen.
That's one of the problems is I think that, I remember reading this science fiction book. I love, like, these apocalyptic novels. And I remember, and I've read dozens of them, and I remember reading one a couple of years ago where it's about the Earth starts to slow. It's total fiction. Mm-hmm. The Earth starts to slow down. It's spinning. And the thing that I remember so distinctly about the beginning is the author says, that it was a catastrophe that was happening slowly, that we couldn't even see it because it was happening literally slowly. Earth had slowed down like half a second or something in the beginning. And of course it continues to slow more. But it feels like the problem with climate change is that we don't see it. I look out my window and there's birds.
Everything looks
normal. But you have documented these things where you are actually seeing it on the fringes. How do you get people to understand the impact? Like, that to me seems to be the biggest challenge.
Yeah, it is. That's why we're stuck with this challenge. And then my brain is instantly going to, like, the political challenge that we face in this country around this. which is unique because the rest of the world gets it.
Yeah.
Like the rest of the world is all China is kicking our ass in terms of climate solutions as well. Right. So the rest of the world gets it. It's an American political problem. It's a problem that was intentionally manufactured and intentionally like spread to confuse the public. So we're right now, the scientists are working to undo the damage that has been done.
What do you mean it was intentionally spread to do?
It's pretty well documented. There's a book and a film called Merchants of Doubt that is a good introduction into it. But it is a very systematic effort that the fossil fuel industry has done to confuse the public on climate change. And we're the only country that has still fallen victim to this. The rest of the world has moved beyond the... It's called a FUD campaign, F-U-D, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And the fossil fuel industry has very actively just tried to espouse doubt around whether or not the science is settled. And they've done such an effective job in this country at that false idea still lives on.
So have you ever met people in the fossil fuel industry and asked them, don't you feel bad?
I haven't asked that explicit question.
Yeah.
I've met a number of people in the fossil fuel industry. A lot of them have... there's this Upton Sinclair quote where it's like, it's hard to convince somebody of a truth if their paycheck depends on them not believing it. That's a butchering of his quote. But if your job, if your livelihood depends on a certain thing, that's what you're doing, it's hard to convince yourself. Just like ethically and morally, it's hard to like... tell yourself that you're doing a bad thing, right? So it's really, really challenging. The fossil fuel industry, the people that I've met, think and have convinced themselves that they are doing a really great service to humanity, that human civilization has succeeded and thrived because of this product, and we need to keep using it. And they've convinced themselves that the science is still up for debate. Like that is the story that I've, and this is coming from a genuine place from people where they just think there's nothing we can do. We can't possibly switch to clean energy. So the consequences of climate change are just something we're going to have to deal with. Like that's,
which is complete bullshit.
That's my take on it. I think it's complete BS. Yeah.
So getting back to the film for a minute. So you went out, you started documenting, these coral reefs that mm-hmm. were bleaching. Can you tell listeners a little bit about how that happens and what it looks like?
So a coral is an animal, which that's the base of it. It's an animal that has
unique animal. It's a very
simplistic animal, right? It's an animal. It doesn't have a brain. It doesn't have organs. But it's an animal that breathes and eats. And it eats and shits. And it goes through those life functions. It can theoretically live forever if the conditions are right, which is pretty fascinating. And it has tiny little plants that live inside of its skin that feed it. The plants practice photosynthesis just like a regular plant does, and it creates energy, and that energy is feeding the animal part.
So the animals that live inside its skin are not part of the coral, they are reliant on that to live.
Yeah, it's like the essence of what they call a symbiotic relationship. Two organisms that live in sync, that depend on each other. You can't have one without the other. The plant that lives in the coral skin can't survive on its own without the coral animal, and the animal can't survive without the plant living in it. It is this beautiful, like, they evolve together, and they feed each other. Imagine we had little solar panels living in our skin, absorbing the sun's energy and feeding us, and that's the only way we could survive, is if we got enough sun and those little solar panels were feeding us. That is what a coral animal is doing. It's beautiful in its simplicity.
And then as a result of it, you have an entire ocean that relies on it.
And then they grow, they get huge, they can build structures. The structures house animals, they house tiny little fish. Like, picture a big tree branch with lots of small birds living in it. The hawks can't go and get all the little birds. Like, that's what's happening in the ocean. All the baby fish live in the branches of these corals, and the big fish and the sharks can't eat them because they're protected by the rock structure that the corals make. And they continue to grow, and they grow and grow, and they can become the size of the Great Barrier Reef, the largest living organism on the planet. You can see it from space. And so it's this really simple relationship that becomes this really big and beautiful thing. What happens is when the water gets too hot for too long, it stresses that relationship. So picture a fever in your human body. Like if right now we're 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, things are good. If our body temperature went up to 101 degrees, we would feel really sick and shitty for a long period of time. What happens in the coral is that the relationship between the plant and the animal breaks down. It basically, the plant starts overproducing, and it's effectively making the animal sick, and the animal then ejects the plant. So if we had bad food in our stomach, we would vomit it out. The coral animal basically says, this is not good for me, and it gets rid of the plants. And so now, that's when they turn white. The plant is what gives it the color, and so the coral, for a period of time, it's still alive, but it's white. It's like this comatose state where it's still functioning. It's still, you know, eating. It has mouths and has thousands and thousands of tiny little mouths, and it can still eat, but it's not doing well because it lost its main source of energy. If the temperature were to drop, it can come back and recover. But if the temperature stays too hot, it just pushes it into death.
So over the past several years, the oceans have been warming as a result of global warming, and they've gone up around 2 to 3 degrees, correct?
The exact numbers I don't remember off the top of my head, but in the last 50 years, it's gone up less than that Celsius. So it's like a degree, roughly a degree Celsius, I believe.
Got it. Yeah. So, and that is now a permanent thing. It's not that it's not going back down.
Correct. Well, that this is the biggest challenge in terms of when we talk about the planet warming, is because the atmosphere isn't continuing to warm as rapidly. The energy is going into the ocean. The ocean is absorbing a lot of the heat and a lot of the energy.
And this is partially why we've seen such an increase in hurricanes.
Exactly.
And other storms.
Coral bleaching is the big one, yeah.
What was that, sorry?
And coral bleaching is the biggest one that we're seeing now, yeah.
And so with the coral bleaching, one of the things that you're seeing is that the coral then dies after the bleaching, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it dead permanently?
Those corals are dead. But that reef can recover. So in a terrestrial analogy, picture clear-cutting a forest. Like those trees are dead, they're chopped down, but that forest can regrow over time as long as you don't keep cutting it down every single year, right?
So now when you kind of look at what's happened with these coral reefs and so many that have died, the fish, what's so fascinating when I was watching the documentary is you see these before and after pictures. Yeah. You see the picture of the coral, and it's beautiful, and it's got these vibrant colors, and there are, you know, clownfish, and it looks like, you know, Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
And then you see the after pictures just 100 days later, and the coral's all dead. There's no fish. There's no life anywhere. Yeah. And you just see hundreds of miles of this. What happens? So what are the effects that then take place? The coral dies. The fish.
The coral dies.
Where do they go?
The small fish. They die. Like they lost their home. Picture everybody in Los Angeles. Like all the buildings just stopped. No electricity. No running water. No functioning system. The coral is, it builds that structure that is the home for all the fish. So if you lose the corals, the fish don't have their home. And the small fish can't swim to an adjacent reef. First of all, the adjacent reef is probably going through the same fate anyway. But the small fish getting in by the bigger fish. Just imagine like Los Angeles runs out of all power and water, and you're told you have to walk to San Francisco to find hope. Like, you're going to lose a lot of people in that process, right? And then all the bad, like, we don't have other, there are no other predators that are trying to eat humans, right? But imagine there were
not yet,
but there are a whole bunch of bears and tigers, you know, and mountain lions.
On the 101 freeway waiting
for us. On the 101 waiting for you as you're walking from here to San Francisco. Like, that's what the ocean is dealing with, the baby fish get eaten by the bigger fish and the bigger fish and the bigger fish. And then the only ones that make it through are the larger predators, the really large fish or sharks and things like that, that can actually swim to an adjacent reef. But still, honestly, like the science isn't even there. We don't really know what happens to everything because they're just gone.
But one of the things that you talk about in the film is that that it affects, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who can no longer fish around the reefs, and that's where they get their source of protein.
11% of the world population depends on fish for their main, for coral reefs, for their main source of protein.
11% from coral 11%. Reefs?
11%. Yeah, yeah.
And so if these coral reefs...
It's like half a billion to a billion people. The numbers estimate, wow. They range. But it's a shitload of the world population.
And are people that... that rely on those, are they going through malnourishment? Is it already
that's
affecting
them? That's
what's
going to happen. So I was just down about a month ago. I was down in Kenya on a coral reef. We're doing some planting and restoration on a coral reef on this tiny little island with 2,000 people. No electricity on this island. They eat fish three meals a day. Like, fish is their main source of protein. They eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And what happens when all of their coral dies and they lose all their fish? That has a huge, huge implication. Malnourishment is going to be a major, major issue. And that then leads to climate refugees. So just drawing another analogy, not on the ocean.
Well, so that was my next question. Is one of the things that I've read about is that that while we can't see the effects of this happening right before our eyes because it's happening slowly, it's happening in the ocean and so on, one of the things that we will start to see is climate refugees and so on.
That's Syria. Syria is a climate refugee story.
So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. It started with a drought. It started with a multi-year abnormal drought. The farmers couldn't grow their food anymore. So a lot of the farmers started going into the cities looking for jobs, looking for food, looking for opportunity. And that, on top of political turmoil, you just have a powder keg. All right, and that's what we're seeing. But when people don't have food to feed their families, they get really upset. And Southeast Asia, the number of people, like the dependence on these reefs for food and for their livelihoods, is going to get majorly disrupted. We're going to see, because of rising sea levels, because of dying corals, because of loss of fish stock, we're going to be seeing a mass migration of people from where they live right now to other places nearby.
So where are people going to be migrating from and where are they going to go to?
All low-lying island nations. I mean, there are islands where they're already designing their entire plan on how they move. How do you migrate an entire population of people? India has built a wall, a fence, I believe mostly, but around Bangladesh. Like, they've already been defending themselves against the influx that they are anticipating coming from Bangladesh. It's a huge question. Like, we have climate refugees in Florida coming from Puerto Rico, right? So you look at hurricanes. It might get to the point where this is something that I hadn't really anticipated until this summer, where you look at the Caribbean and you look at the storms hitting the Caribbean. Those islands might just become uninhabitable.
Yeah.
Like, you can't live there if you're going to get like massive Category 5 hurricanes hitting on a regular basis. Then what happens? Like, all of those people are... The stress that puts on Florida is huge.
Okay, so now one of the questions I have is that when I watched the film, I think there was a lot of sad moments in the movie, for me at least. And again, look, you know, people listening, like, I could give two shits about coral reefs before I watched this, and afterwards I was like, oh my God, what can I do to help stop this from happening? Yeah. And the repercussions that could fall of it. Yeah. But what's that?
I'm going to quote you on that.
Sounds good. But then. There was a scene in the film when the divers are going out to document the coral reefs dying, and there's one of the divers, I don't know where it was, but they had set up shop in the back of a floating restaurant. What country was that in?
That was in New Caledonia.
In New Caledonia.
I'd never heard of the country before this.
And it was, and just for people listening, so the divers have to go out every single day to photograph the coral reefs so they can see the transformation happening. And they, just in this specific place, they end up finding, you know, the place that they would launch from was this restaurant, floating restaurant. And the thing that's so fascinating is that you see the divers in the water, and they're documenting these hundreds of miles of dying reefs and fish that are dying and so on and so forth. And they get back on the boat. On this floating restaurant, and there's techno music playing, and there's people dancing, and they're having a blast jumping in and out of the water. And it was such a perfect analogy for what is happening. But then I also had this feeling of, well, what the hell can I do?
Yeah.
And so what can I do?
It's tough. It's the hardest question that we get faced with all the time, and I wish there was an easy, simple answer to it. I can go into a lot of different thoughts, but ultimately, the way our entire system is structured right now is fundamentally flawed, both in terms of the path that we're on for climate change, but even, honestly, my thoughts more and more lately are just like how capitalism is structured.
Oh, I completely agree with that.
Flawed. And so that's what I've been thinking about quite a bit more recently. But the biggest thing that we need right now is a shift in mindset. That's my take on it. Like we can't continue on the status quo because the ecosystem services that nature provides, our clean air, our clean water, our oxygen supplies, all of these things, we need them and we depend on nature to give us these things. And right now, that's what we're disrupting in a big way. We need to figure out how to get business and government to shift on this quickly.
But here's the problem. So I live in California. We recycle.
Right.
We have a little bin on right. our kitchen counter where right. we put all of our like groceries that we don't end up eating, right. and then we put them in the green bin.
Right.
I drive an electric car now. Yep. Awesome. I don't think I'll ever go back yep. to a gas car, yep. especially after seeing this documentary. Mm-hmm. But yet, you know, you just said you've been yep. on planes all the time.
Yep.
Like that's yeah, contributing,
right? But instead of, and here's one of the things. So the question of what can I do has often been answered by the environmental community with messages of sacrifice. It's do less, don't do that, don't drive, don't fly, don't eat this, don't do that. And that is a mindset that a lot of conservatives have resisted. It's like, oh, you're wanting to restrict business and you're stopping growth and you're hurting the economy. And we're now getting to the stage because of new technology where it doesn't need to be a sacrifice mindset. Instead of don't do these things, the mindset is let's do these things better. So you just said you're driving an electric car. Like that is the solution and the path that we need to be going towards. Instead of flying less, we need to be expediting electric carbon-free flying. There are companies that have small-scale electric planes. NASA and Boeing are working on, and I think JetBlue too, are working on hybrid planes, and then the next round is going to be hydrogen-powered planes, it seems. So we can fly. Like, that's a technical challenge that we know how to solve. It's going to take time, but we can get there eventually. But how do we fly carbon-free? Like, those are the types of questions that we need to be asking.
But those are the type of questions that I can't solve.
That's you can come in the mindset. Like this podcast right now, this is being part of the solution. Talking about driving an electric car is being part of the solution. Finding the friends who you know, maybe, you know, where are you from? Like, so we're doing a lot of work right now in one specific state. We're focusing our work on South Carolina. And what we're
trying to do,
we can go into a long, long conversation. We have a bunch of partners and support there. But it's also a pretty conservative state that we think we can have an influence in. And what we're working on right now is really testing to see with this film, with a campaign, with the right messaging, how can we get more and more people aligned with the solutions, right? Regardless of what somebody thinks about climate change, regardless of what somebody thinks about like this political split, we want to build bridges and we want people all talking about how do we get to these solutions? How do we expedite clean energy? How do we expedite... So how do we expedite all of these solutions and how do we get more and more people like into the conversation in pursuit of those same goals? So that's one of the things that we're really thinking about and focusing on. So is there somebody in your life that might be skeptical of climate change? Like show them
so
the film.
So is this essentially like a change one person? It's like the starfish story, you know, the starfish
yeah.
story, right?
Or the butterfly wing throwing a starfish back in the ocean.
The kid, he's walking yeah. down the beach and there's all these starfish that are stranded on the ocean yeah. and he's picking them up one by one and throwing them in. An old man walks up and he says, "What are you doing, kid? You can't save all these starfish. There's thousands of them." And the kid looks at the old man and looks down at the starfish, throws one of them in the ocean. And he says, "Well, I saved that one."
Yeah.
Is that the approach to this?
I think we need to be trying and testing every possible approach we can.
No, but
for the individual.
For the individual,
I do think that's one of the things like, I can list off all the things about how you can lower your own individual carbon footprint, right? Those lists exist everywhere. I think that's something that everybody should be thinking about on a regular basis. But we need that starfish approach. We need to be planting the seed in more and more people. We need everybody talking about it. You know, if we had a bunch of conservative leaders saying
we do.
Well, but if they were all if conservative leaders were saying we need to be prioritizing protecting the planet, protecting our resources, protecting our clean air, then we would be seeing a faster shift on this.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that's really disheartening is, you know, just at the beginning of this year alone, last year you've seen, you know, Scott Pruitt at the EPA repealing all these regulations, safety hazards, so on and so forth. You see the, you know, the Interior Department, you know, is now saying they're going to allow offshore drilling, all these things that are that even Republican senators in Florida and places like that are saying, no, we don't want that.
They are operating on a fundamentally flawed premise, and they don't understand how the planet works, right? I draw this analogy to a bank account. Like if you think about the planet as a huge, huge bank account where there are all these great resources, and we've been living off of them for such a long time. We've been living off the interest for such a long time. But now, as population is growing, as our usage of these resources is increasing, we're eating into the principal. We're eating more and more and more into the principal. They're operating on a mindset that that it's an infinite bank account, and that you can just take as much as you want. But that's not how nature works. Like, it is a finite bank account. It is limited resources. And it's not like, okay, let's just use all the oil until the oil runs up. I'm talking about like our air, our water, where we live. Like, these are the things that nature is providing us. The scientists are telling us we're eating into the bank account. We're eating into the principal. We're approaching bankruptcy. And we need to realign how we use these resources so we don't hit bankruptcy. That's where we talk about massive systemic collapse. Like, that's what we are approaching, is collapse on a scale that nobody's ever seen before.
So there's been articles about, you know, biological annihilation, you know, all these annihilation, sorry, that you just mentioned this. What are some of the worst case scenario concepts of what could happen?
Worst case scenario concepts. The one that I think about the most is oxygen. So we have hit peak oxygen already. Right now, every inhale that we're taking right now, it's 21% oxygen. Of that 21% oxygen, the majority of it is coming from the ocean. That's coming from phytoplankton, these tiny, tiny, tiny little plants that live in the ocean that photosynthesize, right? They've been on the planet for 4 billion years or so. There was we have the long history of oxygen on the planet. We know when it's gone through peaks and valleys. There's a great oxygenation. Like, we are on this planet because of oxygen, and because of these tiny little machines in the ocean that make our oxygen for us. Those machines, those phytoplankton, are now dying because of temperature and ocean acidity, both consequences of burning fossil fuels. Four of the five mass extinction events that we've seen on the planet have come, in some part, linked to ocean acidification. The fifth one being the asteroid that was a totally different system. But the others are all linked to ocean acidification. We are acidifying the oceans right now because of our burning of fossil fuels at a very, very high and abnormal rate. The phytoplankton, we're pushing them beyond their limits with high ocean temperatures, and we're pushing them beyond their limits with ocean acidity. We've seen a massive drop in phytoplankton populations in the ocean, some parts 40% reduction in population. There are entire parts of the ocean now that are dead zones, so they just can't support life like they normally do. I was just reading something recently, roughly the surface area equivalent of Africa is under-oxygenated. So if you look at the ocean, a volume of that equivalent, surface area volume equivalent to the size of Africa, has less oxygen in it than it should. As we continue to go down this path, we hit a point where the ocean is no longer creating the amount of oxygen that we need. So what does that then look like? What are the consequences of that? So in terms of human health and human, what we need, like the projection, some of the projections by the end of this century, sea level at 21% right now, oxygen, might feel like it feels in Denver. Like, the amount of oxygen is going to get reduced such that
When I go to Denver and I have a hard time breathing
because it's thinner air, but there's less oxygen in the air. You might feel that at sea level. Denver might feel like, you know,
You're on Everest.
Well, that might be a stretch, but pretty close. But that analogy is what we're talking about here. Like, we are reducing the amount of oxygen.
So then what does that do to the trees and the birds and the plants?
Changes all of it. Some things go up, some things go down, some things benefit, some things... But the thing is, that's the biggest thing around climate change, right? These are changes that are happening that we can't fully predict. There are winners and there are losers. But humanity is dependent on the stability of the system. Like, some places on planet Earth are going to do better than others. Like, Canada is going to be really, really awesome at the end of the century.
It's going to be like a beach town in L.A.
Like, and we're seeing everything is migrating north. In the U.S., we're seeing animals, plants growing, agricultural zones. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has identified that the growing regions are all shifting north. So Canada will fare a bit better, but really the underlying problem is, like, where we grow our food and what we can grow in different places, all of that's going to change. The rainfall patterns are changing. So we don't have the stability. Imagine running a business where every year, for years and years and years, you made a certain amount of money, you spent a certain amount of money, you had the cycle, you knew what was going on, and then out of nowhere, everything gets disrupted. You don't know where you're getting your products from, you don't know, your market's disappearing, nobody wants to buy your product, you can't get that material anymore. Like, it's a massive change.
So when you mentioned the five mass extinctions before, do you think that, you know, that there's a world in which we, you know, that the Earth is like, I'm kind of done with you fucking assholes for now?
I have some friends who study this and are experts in this, who anticipate the loss of multiple billions of humans.
Because of the results of climate change.
Because of the climate change is part of this even bigger problem of the Anthropocene, right? And so climate change is one of the most visceral one. But because of what humans are doing to the planet, because of the changes that we're making, I have a number of friends who are really, really concerned about that. And I try not to go down that dark path.
Anyone who's ever listened to this podcast knows. Talk to us about it. What is it? What are some of the theories? Like, what are the...
Well, a lot of it is this oxygen stuff. A lot of it is changing food. A lot of it is war, too. Because when you have disrupted societies, when people don't have food or places
like
to live...
Like Syria.
Just imagine Syria. Like, Syria was around 10 million refugees under that, right? The U.S. government has anticipated 200 million refugees by the end of the century, from various reports and papers that have come out. Like, we're talking about 20x more than what Syria has yielded. And then that, I think some of those estimates are pretty conservative too. Like, we're going to have massive disruption. And when you have it is daunting. It's horrifying sometimes.
So your friends that predict that there will be some sort of mass extinction of humans, what are they? How do they think this plays out? How long does it take to happen? Is there a way to stop it?
I mean, I have a bunch of scientist friends who go for therapy just for this. Like, this is a new field of scientific therapy around how screwed and how fucked up the planet is, that the scientists just need help coping with it.
It sounds like fun, actually.
It's fascinating.
And do they think that, you know, the projection is that the things that you're talking about, oxygen start to go away, we have refugees that come in, there are wars as a result of it, and next thing you know, it's, you know, cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria? Or
that some of them think that. I mean, I personally try not to go down those darkest paths. In my mind, I've looked at what's that worst case scenario, and thinking everything that we do is one step away from that worst case scenario. Like, all of, that's why the work is valuable. That's why we need to get the story out there, because all of this is one little step farther and farther away from that worst case scenario.
But going back to that moment on the boat, at the floating restaurant. You know, I remember I was in Chicago for work, for a meeting that I had to go to the day that Sandy Hook happened, the mass shooting in Connecticut with all these little kids that were killed. And I remember I was walking home from in this meeting, and I saw this restaurant was beaming with people, packed to the brim. And, you know, and I remember thinking to myself, like, yeah, we've all got to eat. We continue with our lives, but we continue with our lives. Like nothing seems to
right.
make anyone change well, or do anything. Like, and that day, two dozen little kids have been shot and killed. And it feels like it's the same thing with climate change. It seems like, you know, you're going to leave after this and what's going to change?
The underlying problem in my mind, and it ties together lots of varying and differing thoughts. The underlying problem is the system of capitalism. Damaging the planet is profitable right now. Like, that's the problem. Selling guns is profitable. Selling war is profitable. Selling drugs and keeping diseases going to sell drugs is profitable. Like, all of these things are profitable for the big industries to continue to cause harm to. And you can have, yes, we can have philanthropists donating $10 million here or $50 million there or $100 million there to try to address these problems. But ultimately, the system is causing the problems far, far, far faster than the tiny little rounding error roll-off percentage that we're putting into trying to address the problems. Like, that's, I don't think we can address climate change unless we address the underlying, like, we can't keep profiting off of damaging the planet.
So one of the things that you started to see in the last election was that there was a lot, this is a discussion that a lot of, you know, the younger generation, millennials, if you will, are asking about and talking yeah. about. There was a moment where Nancy Pelosi was on CNN she was doing a town hall and someone said, you know, my theory, same thing. My theory is that capitalism does not work. Just if you look at it from a financial standpoint, you have, you know, the six richest people in the world have the same amount of wealth as the bottom 3.6 billion.
Yeah.
Ironically, the six richest people, most of them, the majority of them, have made their wealth through tech. As you said, capitalism is designed to wreak havoc. You know, it is a philosophy where we are looking at the biggest gains, not necessarily the implications. Right. But
and
again,
it's going to get worse and worse over the coming years because of technology now.
Okay, so that was where I was going to go. So one of the things that I was noticing in your documentary is that you were using technology to try to solve the problem. But isn't technology creating the problem?
I mean, artificial intelligence and exponential learning for computers is like both exciting and horrifying at the same time.
This is a conversation we have on the podcast a lot.
I'm thinking of working on something along these lines, in fact, because it's this fascinating challenge that we have. We have the world's best computers all trying to maximize profit for a handful of small companies. Like, the capitalism is just siloing money into the hands of fewer and fewer people, right? It's just extracting wealth from the planet, extracting resources and putting money and wealth and resources into fewer and fewer hands. And like that,
but there's
got to
be,
bode well.
So it doesn't bode well, but the thing that I don't understand is what are the implications for that? If we were to go back to, you know, Mott and Bailey castles in the north of England, you know, hundreds of years ago, there were, you know, often feudalistic uprisings and people that were trying to sack the king and the castle and this, that, and the other, because it was similar, but, you know, not on a global scale. There has to be at some point people saying, I've had enough, I'm fed up,
I'm with you. And that's why I think this idea needs to get out there more and more so that people can realize there's so much discontent in this country, right? So we see what has come out with the election last year and so many people being really, really displeased with the state of things. And it was also really, really fascinating the fluidity with which some people were Trump supporters or Bernie supporters, right? The spectrum has gotten so far to the left and so far to the right that it's completely gone full circle. And there were lots of Americans that were like, oh, I could vote for either one of these two people. I think what this is in response to is, and I don't know, I'm just like, these are new thoughts sort of developing right now, but it's a response to frustration with the status quo and frustration with how business is operating currently. I don't know, we're on this really, really interesting time where I think the general population is going to come to some awakening of we need to really redesign our system. And what does that look like? And those are the questions that I don't have answers to. I don't know who has those answers. Like, how do we redesign a system that works for everybody, that works for our society?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think no matter how you redesign the system, that on paper it's always going to look good.
Right.
Communism looks great on paper until
right.
people want a bigger house right. and a faster right. car and better food than their neighbor. But I do think that, you know, that we have an opportunity right now. There is so much discontent. It's funny because, you know, I have guests on this podcast that range from CEOs of, you know, CEO of Disney, people who are specialists in foreign affairs or legal matters or mm-hmm. tech or culture or whatever. And the conversation always ends up right where we are.
Hmm.
And I think that, I think that it is everyone who is feeling this, but they also feel helpless. Like, what can I do?
Yeah.
And I think that that's the thing that, that I think about a lot and have been trying to kind of, you know, make changes to do. And, you know, when I look at this film and I looked at your last film, Chasing Ice, and I think about the direction that this planet is going in for my children, it's something that I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah.
You know.
I think we're all looking for the answer to that question.
All right, so let's kind of yeah. let's wrap up with some happy stuff.
Yeah,
I promise we'll go there. So, what are some of the things that you have done? You've been documenting yeah. these things for 10 years yeah. now. What are some of the things that you've done that you feel are making a difference
yeah.
beyond the movies that yeah. the average listener can do?
Well, the average, I mean, as you were saying, electric car, I got an electric car and put solar.
So electric car is huge, right? It actually makes a huge difference.
If you're driving on it, there are pros and cons, right? There are critiques of what an electric car is doing and the batteries. But here's really what we need to do. We need to electrify everything, and then we need to clean up our electricity production. Those two things do a massive, massive dent at climate change. We can also talk about food, agriculture, animal emissions. There are a bunch of different ways that we're emitting greenhouse gases. But really, there's a two-step process that covers most of it. Electrify everything, clean up our electricity production. So in that pursuit, even if your electric car is being powered by energy coming from a coal-fired power plant, it's still more efficient than a gas-guzzling vehicle. And if that coal-fired power plant gets replaced with renewable clean energy, then then it's massive, massive reduction. So, like, those are the steps that we need to be taking. If you can afford to put solar panels in your house, do it. If you can afford an electric car, do it. And the more and more people,
well, actually, electric cars are often less expensive than the gas.
They've gotten so cheap, and yeah. that's the thing. Like, this conversation right now wouldn't have looked the same way 5 or 10 years ago.
It wouldn't have looked the same way 2 years ago.
2 years ago, I couldn't. Yeah. I couldn't afford an electric car, but I bought one about 2 years ago. Yeah.
And then what else? So from a food standpoint, what do you tell people to do?
Eat better. So be aware of your food and eat better food. So just one other thing in regards to, there's a big conversation around organic and pesticides or not. One of the things that I learned on this project that I knew nothing about are dead zones in the ocean. So our use of fertilizers in the continental US, those fertilizers run downstream and they go into the rivers and a lot of them end up in the Gulf of Mexico. And the Gulf of Mexico is a massive dead zone right now because of a huge influx of fertilizer that is causing algae to propagate. And it just suffocates, it just consumes all the oxygen, and they're dead zones in the ocean because of our use of fertilizers. I don't think farmers realize that they are killing the ocean. Right? They don't realize that their practice is killing the ocean. So we need to be moving away from those things. The more organic you can do, the better. With regards to meat consumption, eat smaller animals and eat animals less frequently. Like, eat mostly plants. The things that are better for the planet are actually better for your health too, right? So eat quality meat. If you want to eat steak, grass-fed, free-range, grass-fed and grass-finished steak is actually carbon negative. Like the amount of land that's being used to support those animals is really, really high, and that's a carbon negative source, as opposed to the factory farming meat where you've got thousands and thousands of cattle in a tiny little area eating the wrong foods and they're emitting lots of greenhouse gases.
It's interesting that you say this because a couple weeks back I had Tim Wu on the podcast, and he's a legal expert at Columbia. He wrote the book The Master Switch, which was about, you know, he's the guy who came up with net neutrality, the term net neutrality. And he was saying that he's working on a new project now. But one of the things that he's trying to think, the new project is about bigness and how it's not good for society, right? And he was saying that the way he is approaching it from a personal perspective is he doesn't think about things as what am I going to buy, you know, where, what am I going to shop for? But he thinks about it as what am I supporting? So if he buys a steak from, you know, from a farm that is, you know, putting hormones into the, whatever it is, like he's now supporting that. And so it sounds like you're saying something very similar, is that like, you know, if you're going to eat these things, you're thinking about, think about the fact that you are supporting these effects.
You are part of the problem. Like if you are buying you know, they call it capos.
What is that?
I'm blanking on what the acronym stands for right now. But it's about the concentrated food lots for animal industry. You're being part of the problem there if you're not supporting the better solutions, right? I can't invest in fossil fuels ethically at all. I don't know how people do that, right? But there are colleges that are doing a huge divestment campaign. Where is your money? Like, where is your retirement account? Like, is your are you walking the talk in terms of where your money is invested? Are you making, like, everything you buy is a vote, right? So you're voting every single time you make a purchase. So I resonate with what you're saying. Tim's concept is there. Like, you're making that vote through your food purchases three times a day. And you can be supporting things that are good and sustainable for the planet, or you can be supporting things that are part of the problem.
So
shrimp, like one of the worst things for the ocean is shrimp. That's what I feel great pain about.
What do you mean?
Because, like, eating shrimp is one of the worst things you could possibly do for the ocean. The way they harvest shrimp, they just set up these huge nets and they like scrape the bottom. And when they pull the nets up, there's a lot of bycatch. There are a lot of animals that aren't shrimp that they catch by accident in the process of collecting shrimp. Now, unfortunately, the way the systems are set up, they don't just take these fish and then sell the fish. Most of the time, those fish just literally get tossed off the boat and go back into the ocean as dead fish. They get suffocated when they're in the nets and they get tossed overboard. And now you've got a bunch of dead shrimp, a bunch of dead fish as the byproduct of them trying to harvest shrimp. So I haven't eaten shrimp in multiple years now.
Because of that.
Because of that problem.
All right, can we end on a positive note with something?
There are sustainable fish that you can eat. All right, Whole Foods is actually pretty good about like sustainable fish. There's an app that you can get from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. I think it's just called Seafood Watch, I think the app is called.
And it'll tell you what to
eat. You can tell what's sustainable and what's not sustainable. The smaller, the better. Like oysters. Eat all the oysters you want. Oysters are great.
Because they
clean the ocean. You can farm them. They're filtering
catfish
water.
Catfish you can farm?
Catfish I don't know about. Maybe, probably, yeah.
And eat more vegetables.
Eat more vegetables. Eat good, clean vegetables.
So just to wrap up, The movie came out on Netflix when?
Last summer. We premiered at Sundance a year ago.
And has there anything that's changed in the Carl world since then?
Well, countless stories and anecdotes and feedback that we get in social media. I don't even know where to start. Our team, some of the subjects of the film are really working on how do we save and protect coral reefs. Like how right now it's sort of a last ditch effort, and it's really the mindset right now is how do we create seed banks in the ocean so that if temperatures stabilize at some point, can these corals be the seed banks that can repropagate and resupply the rest of the world's oceans with corals? The corals do a mass spawning, which is in and of itself super, super fascinating. For a particular coral species, at one night, based on the full moon, at a certain time, all the corals will release all their eggs and gametes and sperm at the same time of the night, like wow. clockwork, and you'll see just billions.
Do they know where it comes from or why?
It's linked in with the lunar cycle. I don't fully understand it. The corals get it. We don't get it, right? But they're all, imagine everybody, like all the corals at the same time. Clockwork. I mean, literally, we were on a boat, and our dive master, the scientists there on the boat, were like, wait for it, wait longer. And we're all just sitting on the boat with all our gear just waiting, and they're looking at their watch, and they say, now, let's go in the water. And we all jump in the water, and we're down there, and like 5 minutes later, literally, all of the corals just start erupting. And it's just this mass wow. coral orgy happening in the ocean at the same time
of
the
night. Watching this whole thing
happen? Just watching coral sex throughout the entire ocean. When you get back on the boat, you smell a little funky, but it is this fascinating feat of nature, and nature can heal itself. Nature knows how to heal itself. Like, mm-hmm. life knows how to survive if you give it the chance, and life is constantly changing. Like right now, that's the big, like the planet's going to be fine. It's just humans.
It's just a matter of whether we're on it.
It's just humans are on it, right? Life is going to continue. Life's going to be fine. And it'd be nice to keep these coral reefs around. It'd be nice for beautiful and aesthetic reasons, but also for the services that they provide. And so Richard and his team are working on that. We're working on a big education campaign. The biggest thing, the easiest thing, is just share the movie. Like we put all the effort and work into getting all of these ideas into the movie itself. So invite friends over, do a screening, just kick back, like host a screening at your house every week. Invite another friend over to just come over. Let's have some beers and watch the movie.
Just some organic.
Organic, healthy yes, beers. Exactly.
Not in a yeah. plastic bottle.
Yeah. Don't use plastic. Yeah,
no, don't use plastic. That's a waste. Well, thank you so yeah. much. I really appreciate you taking the time. The movie, absolutely. Again, thanks, is Chasing Coral. It's on Netflix, and yeah. I definitely urge everyone to watch it. Yeah, it's fascinating and scary and sad, but also uplifting a little
uplifting
too.
Uplifting and inspiring, hopefully.
Thanks. Thanks for coming out.
Thanks so much.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Hey, Nick, so that was pretty fascinating and very terrifying. And on it was, a fascinating...
It was fascinating, right? I mean, I didn't expect that it was going to go there, but I found it, you know, really, really fascinating, all the things he had to say.
Yeah, it's true. Although when you set people up for pondering the sixth extinction, I imagine that they go to a dark place. But without belaboring, you know, your conversation really dovetailed, to me at least, with a piece that you wrote on The Hive this week about really this sort of, you know, whether we're beginning to see the end of Facebook, whether this a demise really is coming. It seems like, you know, you've actually been kind of working your way towards this mentally for some time. Listeners of this podcast will remember Tim Wu and Scott Galloway have noted in the past on previous episodes of Inside the Hive that Facebook just isn't as popular as it used to be. People kind of hate it. And also, by the way, it might have like totally, you know, set a dumpster fire on our democracy. Do you want to outline your thesis a little bit and refresh us on where you took it?
Well, I just want to you know, give you some major props right here, because you have found like an amazing editor. You found a perfect segue from climate change to social media. And you did it. It was smooth. I mean, you kind of like Donald Trump there. So, you know,
well, the podcasting money makes it worth it.
So, yeah. So, I wrote this week a piece that actually, you know, kind of blew up a little bit on social media, ironically enough, talking about how, you know, Facebook is in trouble. And one of the things that I have seen, and it's anecdotal, there's no data, you know, there's no big data to back this up, and I have theories of why there's no big data to back this up, and we can get to that in a little bit. But, you know, more and more, I wrote in this article that, you know, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, everyone I knew had a Facebook account, and they had a Facebook app on their phone, and they had Messenger or whatever it was. And now, I mean, I'm not just over-exaggerating when I say this. Pretty much every single human being I know has deleted Facebook from their phone because they feel like it's too invasive. They're sick of it. They don't feel happy when they use it. There's all these things that have come about as a result of it. And I started to notice that, and we were seeing Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg respond to all the fake news stuff, saying that they kind of have to rethink what Facebook is, and there's been a lot of questions around whether those thoughts from Zuckerberg specifically are moral, if the company is trying to be ethical in realizing that Facebook and social media are not the best thing for the world, or if there's something else. And my theory is that it's predominantly something else, and the predominance is that people are just fed up with it. And I know there's been articles written 1,000 times about the end of Facebook, but I really feel like there's a tide change that's happened.
Well, one of the interesting things that this is actually not in the story. I'm curious to get your take on it. But one of the sort of trending assumptions after Facebook changed its algorithm to de-emphasize news and emphasize what our friends and family are sharing is the idea that Zuckerberg both wants to get into China and sort of needs to continue to grow Facebook at the extraordinary clip that it's been growing for the past 10 years. So do you think that his interest in getting in China will sort of, I guess, narrow Facebook's scope so that it'll really just be truly a social network among friends and family members? Do you think that in growing scale, he's going to limit what Facebook connects us with and to?
I think that what's going to happen is that, and look, predicting this stuff is you know, it's prediction suicide, because anything can come about that you don't realize. I mean, you know, I predicted last year that Twitter would be, you know, its stock price would have fallen dramatically by the end of the year, and it had actually risen risen a bit. And the thing that I hadn't anticipated, and no one had anticipated at the beginning of 2017, was that Donald Trump was going to use Twitter as his permanent mouthpiece, even when he was president, and also that he was going to be as bombastic and asinine and ridiculous as he was before he was president on that network. Simultaneously, I didn't predict that Facebook was going to use everything it could to destroy Snap, and put Snapchat out of business, essentially. I mean, they didn't put them out of business, but they are in trouble. And therefore, advertising dollars have now gone back from Snap to Twitter. And now with Facebook saying they're going to get out of the news game, they're going to go to Twitter even more. And so there are all these outside forces that you can never really predict in this business. But I think one thing you can predict is how users are going to react to things. And the thing that we have all predicted correctly is that Twitter has had a really hard time growing because of the volatility on the platform, and it doesn't make people feel great, and so on and so forth. And Facebook, I think, is reaching a crescendo where it is having a difficult time trying to get its traditional users that have been on the platform for a decade or so to want to continue to do it. It's, you know, they're kind of fed up with it. People are sick of there's like a three-prong thing that's going on. The first is just the experience. Like, you don't go on Facebook and think like, oh, I feel so great about myself now. You either go on there and you see something someone else is doing that's better than what you did and you feel like shit, or you go on there and you have to, like, you know, you've posted just a picture of your kid and someone's complaining because you're sitting on the swing set incorrectly, like some kid that you went to high school with has got a viewpoint on that. Or
yeah, or you learn that Hillary Clinton's running a pedophilia ring in the bottom of a pizza.
Yeah, yeah. Or you learn about the pedophilia ring that doesn't exist. Or there's a litany of those things. The other thing is Facebook's privacy is still to this day terrifying. You know, there was an article that just came out about how Facebook scientifically looks at the dust on the lens of your smartphone camera from your photos to determine who you're friends with in the photos. If I take a picture of you and I send it to you and we're not friends on Facebook and you upload it, it knows, oh, well, Nick Bilton has taken photos and there's the same dust particles and John has the same dust particles on this image, so they are friends. There's that's happening. And I also think that we've been at war with algorithms for the last few years, and they've gotten better and better, and they know how to suck us in and manipulate us into looking at things. And, you know, like the perfect example is that pop-up you get where it's like, you know, Nick and John are talking about a photo. And you're like, well, what the fuck is the photo? I have to click on the photo. Like, And then you're like, it's just a photo of a cappuccino. Like, why did I do that? And I think that in this war with algorithms, the thing that most people are realizing is the only way to play the game is not to play it. To win the game is not to play at all. And I think that, you know, I think that Facebook is fully aware of that. They have more levers and levers and data points and this, that, and the other that they can see everything that's happening, and they can spot trends before they happen. And I think that they're spotting the trend that there are people that are not happy on the service and are kind of abandoning it.
Yeah, one thing that is obvious is it's a funny world out there in social media, where you're either kind of with Facebook or you're against it. You know, you've said to me a million times that the Zuckerberg philosophy is pretty simple. He tries to buy you, and if you don't consent, he basically tries to you know, compete against you and enroll you. But one of the funny things that I remember Galloway mentioning on this podcast about a month or two ago is that Facebook is basically just a roll-up at this point of large social networks, right? Whereas Apple is in many different kinds of businesses. Amazon is in like a bazillion businesses, you know, everything from bookstores to supermarkets to movie studio. Facebook does largely one thing. Do you think that the regulatory issues are also going to become eventually too much for Facebook to bear?
I don't think they're going to become too much for Facebook to bear, because Facebook has, you know, a behemoth of
lawyers. Yeah, the
lawyers.
Best lobbyists in the world, of course, right.
Yeah, and they're spending millions and millions of dollars on lobbyists and lawyers and anticipating all this stuff. And, you know, look, I mean, I write these articles about Facebook and the bad things they do, but, you know, as a company, kind of bullying and the privacy stuff. But I know a lot of people that work there that I think are really good people, and they sure believe in what they're doing. They just see it from a different perspective. But you know, even this week at Davos, you know, one of the things that you're seeing happening is like leaders like Theresa May and people like George Soros and other folks that are there that are talking about how there needs to be regulation on these big tech companies, whether it's Google or Facebook or Amazon. But that's a conversation that you're seeing happen. And I've covered Davos before. I've been there. I've never heard that conversation before. This is the first time that I have heard, you know, world leaders talking about this in the way that they are. And I think that, you know, there was an article earlier this year, or sorry, last year, by Ben Smith on BuzzFeed, where he was talking about how these tech companies are now the new oil companies, are the new Rockefellers and so on, and that they are going to use their power and their might to ensure that no one can compete with them, and we're seeing that happen right now. And you know, just ask Evan Spiegel what it's like to, you know, have a better product than Facebook and see it completely copied and your company decimated as a result of it.
So let me ask you one final question. And it's an impossible one, so feel free to just totally make up the answer. But where do you see Facebook and the competitive landscape in 5 years, let's say?
Well, I just want you to know I make up every answer, so I should just be blunt about
that. Yeah.
Where do I see Facebook in 5 years? If it were me, if I ran that company, and I don't, and I would probably have a few private jets, because that's important. Mm-hmm. But if I ran the company, what I would be trying to do is I would see the writing on the wall that social media is not going to be here forever in the way that it has been in the past.
Right.
And that the future. So here's what I think is happening, that, you know, more and more these places that we were used to coalesce around groups of people, it was literally everyone in the same room together. That was Facebook, that was Twitter, that was kind of Snap in some ways, depending on how you shared stories, that was Instagram, that's what those things are. What's happening now is everyone I know is in group chats on Telegram sometimes on WhatsApp or on iMessages or whatever it is. And those are becoming these mini social networks, right? So
right.
I have friends that have a Bitcoin group chat on Telegram. I have friends that have a photography one on iMessages and things like that. And so the concept of social media is becoming much smaller and more private, and you can say the things that you want to say knowing that no one else is going to be able to comment on them unless they have been invited to this group. And so what the future of Facebook is to me, and I think Zuckerberg kind of gets this, which is why he bought Oculus VR, is it's much more about community around experiences. And so if it were me, I would be like doubling down on, you know, creating TV shows and films and games and all these other things that are, that make you feel good afterwards, that you've like, you felt like you've actually done something with your time, but around community, so that you and I could like watch a documentary together, like, you know, Chasing Carl, and have comments about it, or whatever it is, you know, all these different things like that. And so I think that that if the company recognizes what the future of social is, which they probably do better than anyone, that they will kind of move away from just social media around nonsense and more around content.
Well, let's hope, right? I mean, it's...
I think the question is and I, you know, based on my own actions, I think I can answer this question, but the question is what, you know, most people have 150 friends or less on Facebook. And so if you share a video of you and your kid, do you mind that 150 people can see it and comment on it? And the answer is you probably don't want your parents and your coworker and the guy you went to high school with who still lives in the same town commenting on the same thing. And so will that go somewhere else? And I think that that's still to be determined, but based on the way I share things now, that's the way I do it.
Yeah, it seems so logical that that as social media evolves, it would actually evolve in the way that our lives have evolved, where you have a private life, a professional life, a public-ish life, and that you would kind of want many of those things to be separated.
Completely.
It's just funny, you know. I'm not trying to make a sort of sweeping statement about Silicon Valley or humanity, but it's funny how the arrogance with which so much of the tech industry has tried to remake life is just being humbled by recognizing that in many ways human behavior is unassailable, and there are certain sort of, you know, fundamental characteristics of how we live that that like kind of work, you know. So it will be interesting to see how it all turns out. But anyway, Nick, thanks for
yeah. You know what? If it doesn't work out, at least we can rest assured that as we begin the Halcyon extinction, the sixth one, that we'll probably all be dead anyway. Some maybe an asteroid, dinosaurs returning, you know, CO2 destroying the Earth, whatever it is. But, you know, so we have that to look forward to.
On next week's episode, we'll talk about the seventh extinction.
Have a great week, John. Thank
you
so
much. I'll see you then.
Thanks to my guest today, Jeff Orlowski. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a glowing, amazing 17-star review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. Thanks to my editor, John Kelly, not the guy in the White House, the other one. And thank you all for listening. I will see you all next week.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
From PRX.